Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Anne Ball, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Many observers are making comparisons between the current worldwide spread of the coronavirus and the events of World War II. The comparisons have appeared in recent days as the world faces possibly the most serious threat since the last truly international war. Several world leaders have called on people to show the fearlessness of those who lived through World War II. Some people have warned of an invisible enemy, one that could cause death, damage the world's economy, and create social problems. Others say it is not helpful to make such comparisons and that they only add to the fear over the coronavirus. The names, places, and battles of World War II bring up many emotions. Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Franklin Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill. Places, too, can have emotions tied to them. Auschwitz, Pearl Harbor, and Midway Island, and Stalingrad. Events also can bring emotions. The Siege of Leningrad, the German Blitz of London, the Allied bombing of Dresden, and the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is estimated that 85 million people died in World War II. The coronavirus has been blamed for tens of thousands of deaths. Some people worry whether these comparisons are useful or just serve as a metaphor. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was born 10 years after World War II ended. She grew up in East Germany, a country at the time under the influence of the former Soviet Union. Last week, she spoke to her countrymen on television. She said, "Since the Second World War, there has been no challenge to our nation that has demanded such united action." U.S. President Donald Trump has called himself a wartime president. He has used, or said he would use, the 70-year-old Defense Production Act to battle shortages of medical supplies and equipment like masks and ventilators. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and many media opinion writers have urged him to use the law. Queen Elizabeth of Britain seemed to recall her young years during the war when she drove military vehicles in Britain. "At times such as these, I am reminded that our nation's history has been forged by people and communities coming together to work as one," she said. Italy has had more deaths than any other nation from the coronavirus so far. Italian Premier Giuseppe Conte said on television Saturday that he was tightening the country's restrictions on movement and closing everything except businesses that provide food and medicine. "We are facing the most serious crisis that the country has experienced since World War II," Conte said. Governments are reacting differently to the problems of keeping people working and important industries operating. Rescue plans started by several Western countries remind some people of the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was a $15 billion American plan to rebuild Europe after the end of World War II. Today, modern economies not only depend on financial resources, but also on the Internet to connect government services and businesses. Some people wonder what would happen if the Internet collapsed. They say such a happening would be much like the use of an atom bomb, an event of unimaginable destruction. I'm John Russell.
Many people enjoy having plants inside their homes, especially when it is cold outside. But sometimes houseplants need a little help. If they are struggling, houseplants will let you know. They show discolored leaves and their stems droop or no longer stand strong or tall. And there will be little or no growth. Plants send signals simply by the way they look, said Don Pettinelli, an extension educator at the University of Connecticut. If they aren't getting enough light, the leaves will yellow or turn brown, and they will be slow to develop. Leaves with the wrong colors can also mean other problems. These include root problems, insects hurting the plant, the wrong soil moisture, or bad light conditions or temperatures. One of America's most popular houseplants is the African violet. It has violet or purple-colored flowers. These plants do not like to be cold, but they also get stressed when it is too warm. Pettinelli said they start to droop when they are cold, and they will not flower if they are hot. A good way to help renew tired houseplants is by giving them a plant haircut. In the gardening world, cutting back plants is called pruning. Pruning serves many needs. Diana Allfuth is a gardening expert with University of Wisconsin Extension. She said pruning helps with shaping, removing dead matter, and keeping the plants from drooping. Pruning then results in strong new growth, she said. It also helps keep a plant bushier, meaning thicker and more round. I'm Ann Ball.
The World Health Organization is partnering with major video game makers in support of online gaming as a way to keep people indoors to help fight the new coronavirus. The partnership comes as online video game play has increased as governments across the world ordered citizens to stay home in an effort to stop the virus from spreading. In mid-March, Italy's top telecommunications company announced internet traffic had increased more than 70% in the days since the government enforced quarantine rules, Bloomberg reported. Telecom Italia said a big reason for the rise was an increase in play for video games like Fortnite and Call of Duty. In the United States, Internet service provider Verizon reported a 75% jump in gaming activity on its networks during the second week in March, when stay-at-home directives began to take effect. 18 video game industry leaders teamed up with the WHO to create a program called #PlayApartTogether. The companies say they will share messages about the virus with gamers and urge them to follow the WHO's safety advice. The messages will include suggestions on things such as physical distancing and cleanliness. They will also advise on ways to behave around others to avoid spreading or catching the virus. Many large U.S. gaming events and contests have been canceled because of the coronavirus spread. The companies promised to create special events, exclusives, activities, and rewards for players online in the coming weeks. One of the companies taking part is Activision Blizzard Inc. It is one of the world's largest video game developers. The company has produced many popular games, including Call of Duty, World of Warcraft, Diablo, and Candy Crush. The head of Activision Blizzard, Bobby Kotick, said in a statement that the coronavirus crisis has created a major need for people to find ways to stay safely connected to each other. Games are the perfect platform because they connect people through the lens of joy, purpose, and meaning, Kotick said. Ray Chambers is the WHO's ambassador for global strategy. In a tweet, he wrote that the video game industry's worldwide reach can get the message out. More physical distancing plus other measures will help to flatten the curve plus save lives, Chambers wrote. The WHO's cooperation with the gaming industry comes after the organization decided last year to officially declare gaming disorder a behavioral addiction on its list of diseases. The new partnership got some criticism online. One gamer wrote to Ray Chambers on Twitter, "Oh, that's ironic. Last I remembered, you guys classified us gamers as addicts. Now you praise us because we already know social distancing?" Paula Zirinsky, chief marketing officer for the intelligence-gathering company K2 Intelligence, also reacted on Twitter. "You can't have it both ways. Gaming can be addictive. WHO said it themselves last year," she tweeted. "With kids returning to virtual classrooms, why encourage gameplay? The only winners in this are the gaming companies." However, the WHO's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, praised the organization's cooperation with the industry as another useful tool in fighting the virus. "Thank you, Raymond Chambers, for mobilizing the gaming industry to feature WHO advice on COVID-19 to their users," he tweeted. "We all must #PlayApartTogether to beat the coronavirus." The maker of the hugely popular mobile game Pokemon Go has also said it would make changes and create new events to support indoor activities between players around the world. And many of the world's top professional gamers came together to record a public service announcement to raise awareness among players on ways to prevent the spread of the virus. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. On a cold October day in 1957, the Soviet Union launched a small satellite into orbit around the Earth. Radio Moscow made the announcement.
The first artificial Earth satellite in the world has now been created. This first satellite was today successfully launched in the USSR.
The world's first satellite was called Sputnik 1. Sputnik was an important propaganda victory for the Soviets in the Cold War with the United States. Many people believed the nation that controlled space could win any war, and the Soviet Union had reached outer space first. The technology that launched Sputnik probably began in the late 19th century. A Russian teacher of that time, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, decided that a rocket engine could provide power for a space vehicle. In the early 1900s, another teacher, American Robert Goddard, tested the idea. He experimented with small rockets to see how high and how far they could travel. In 1923, a Romanian student in Germany, Hermann Oberth, showed how a spaceship might be built and launched to other planets. Rocket technology improved during World War II. It was used to produce flying bombs. Thousands of people in Britain and Belgium died as a result of V-1 and V-2 rocket attacks. The rockets were launched from Germany. The larger V-2 rocket had the ability to hit the United States. After the war, it became clear that the United States and the Soviet Union, allies in wartime, would become enemies in peacetime. So both countries employed German scientists to help them win the race to space. The Soviets took the first step by creating Sputnik. This satellite was about the size of a basketball. It got its power from a rocket. It orbited Earth for 3 months. Within weeks, the Soviets launched another satellite into Earth orbit, Sputnik 2. It was much bigger and heavier than Sputnik 1. It also carried a passenger, a dog named Laika. The United States joined the space race about 3 months later. It launched a satellite from Cape Canaveral in the southeastern state of Florida. The satellite was called Explorer 1. It weighed about 14 kilograms. Explorer 1 went into a higher orbit than either Sputnik, and its instruments made an important discovery. They found an area of radiation about 960 kilometers above Earth. The next major space victory belonged to the Soviets. They sent the first man into space. In April 1961, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin was launched in the vehicle known as Vostok. He remained in space for less than 2 hours. He landed safely by parachute near a village in Russia. Less than a month later, the United States sent its first astronaut into space. He was Alan Shepard. Shepard remained in space only about 15 minutes. He did not go into Earth orbit. That flight came in February 1962 with John Glenn. By 1965, the United States and the Soviet Union were experimenting to see if humans could survive outside a spacecraft. In March, Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov became the first person to do so. A strong tether connected Leonov to the spacecraft. The tether gave him oxygen to breathe, and it permitted him to float freely at the other end. After about 10 minutes, Leonov had to return to the spacecraft. He said he regretted the decision. He was having such a good time. A little more than 2 months later, an American would walk outside his spacecraft. Astronaut Edward White had a kind of rocket gun. This gave him some control of his movements in space. Like Leonov, White was sorry when he had to return to his spacecraft. Later that year, 1965, the United States tried to have one spacecraft get very close to another spacecraft while in orbit. This was the first step in getting spacecraft to link or dock together. Docking would be necessary to land men on the moon. The plan called for a Gemini spacecraft carrying two astronauts to get close to an unmanned satellite. The attempt failed. The target satellite exploded as it separated from its main rocket. America's space agency decided to move forward. It would launch the next in its Gemini series. Then someone had an idea. Why not launch both Geminis? The second one could chase the first one instead of a satellite. Again, things did not go as planned. It took two tries to launch the second Gemini. By that time, the first one had been in orbit about 11 days. Time was running out. The astronauts on the second Gemini moved their spacecraft into higher orbits. They got closer and closer to the Gemini ahead of them. They needed to get within 600 meters to be considered successful. After all the problems on the ground, the events in space went smoothly. The two spacecraft got within one-third of a meter of each other. The astronauts had made the operation seem easy. In January 1959, the Soviets launched a series of unmanned lunar rockets. The third of these flights took pictures of the far side of the moon. This was the side no one on Earth had ever seen. The United States planned to explore the moon with its unmanned Ranger spacecraft. There were a number of failures before Ranger 7 took pictures of the moon. These pictures were made from a distance. The world did not get pictures from the surface of the moon until the Soviet Luna 9 landed there in February 1966. For the next few years, both the United States and the Soviet Union continued their exploration of the moon. Yet the question remained, which one would be the first to put a man there? In December 1968, the United States launched Apollo 8 with three astronauts. The flight proved that a spacecraft could orbit the moon and return to Earth safely. The Apollo 9 spacecraft had two vehicles. One was the command module. It could orbit the moon, but could not land on it. The other was the lunar module. On a flight to the moon, it would separate from the command module and land on the moon's surface. Apollo 10 astronauts unlinked the lunar module and flew it close to the moon's surface. After those flights, everything was ready.
12, 11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running.
On July 16, 1969, three American astronauts lifted off in Apollo 11. On the 20th, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin entered the lunar module called the Eagle. Michael Collins remained in the command module, the Columbia. The two vehicles separated.
25 feet, guys looking good, down a half.
It was a dangerous time. The Eagle could crash, or it could fall over after it landed. That meant the astronauts would die on the moon.
4 forward, drift into the right level. 30 seconds forward.
Millions of people watched on television or listened on the radio. They waited for Armstrong's message.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. Then they waited again. It took the astronauts more than 3 hours to complete the preparations needed to leave the lunar module. Finally, the door opened. Neil Armstrong climbed down first. He put one foot on the moon, then the other foot, and then came his words from so far away.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Man on the moon. Oh, boy. Boy.
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute.
CBS television newsman Walter Cronkite shared the excitement that he and so many people felt as man first walked on the surface of the moon. Later, Cronkite would remember the historical significance of that moment in 1969.
It's hard, I think, to imagine our emotions at the moment. It really was something that had to grip you. It was as if you could have stood at the dock and waved goodbye to Columbus. You knew darn good and well that this was the real history in the making.
Armstrong walked around. Soon, Aldrin joined him.
They're setting up the flag now.
The two men placed an American flag on the surface of the moon. They also collected moon rocks and soil. When it was time to leave, they returned to the Eagle and guided it safely away. They reunited with the Columbia and headed for home. The United States had won the race to the moon.
The thing that made this one particularly gripping was that sense of history, that if this was successful, this was a date that was going to be in all of the history books from time evermore. I think we sensed that at the time, just sitting there at the Cape and watching that great beast get on its way, that this was it.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.